Our lectionary today gives us two very dramatic readings. Paul's extremely dramatic presentation of how the wisdom of the cross of Christ overthrows so much of what we would think of as normal. And then Jesus' behavior in the temple challenges so much of what his contemporaries assumed was normal about their religious practice. And both of these readings can be commented in all sorts of different ways. But today, as they fall during Lent, it seems to me that our best angle is to talk about what these readings can tell us about how we can understand what it means for us to be sinful. How we can maybe even understand the process by which we get to be sinful, so that we can perhaps be a bit more attentive to the spaces where we could maybe step off that particular conveyor. So in our first reading, we have this extraordinary set of statements. The Jews, good religious people, are looking for signs of God's power. They're looking for God in action. And the Greeks are looking for wisdom. They're more cerebral. They're more intellectual. They're looking for the truth. They're looking to be convinced. And what do we get? We get the execution of a tradie from an unimpressive part of town on a cross by the Roman invading armies. That's what we get. And Paul says the wisdom of that moment and the power of that moment, which appears to be completely foolish and completely powerless, is actually mightier in its foolishness, in its triviality, than anything else in all of creation. People just don't understand. They don't understand the nature of God's power. They don't understand the nature of God's wisdom. How do they get to understand it? Because to think that you need to be in a special club in order to understand God's wisdom actually opens the door to a whole new range of possible sins, predominantly the sin of religious self-righteousness, which, as any reader of any gospel can tell you, is the sin about which Jesus is more concerned than any other. And it's reassuring reading our scriptures to see that the people who seem to get stuff wrong about God more than anybody else are the good religious people. So here in our gospel today, we have Jesus walking into the temple and overthrowing a whole range of practices which people there thought were normal. And so they challenge him and they say, "What's your authority for doing this? And by the way, why did you do this?" And Jesus could have responded, "Because you have misunderstood, and therefore you are doing things that are wrong. Wisdom is flawed, and action is flawed. Understanding and action." More than that, Jesus says everything that you do needs to be reframed in terms of a new and bigger understanding, which you are simply unaware of at this point. Now, fair enough, it hadn't been revealed in the form that it was to be revealed. The disciples themselves, who of course are just learners, that's just what the word means, only begin to understand the implications of this after the crucifixion. And of course, the majority of witnesses of that crucifixion themselves had absolutely no idea what was going on. If we distinguish these two aspects, though, for a bit, because this might be helpful. We're dealing here with two kinds of limits, if you like, the Greek limit and the Jewish limit, in the terms of Paul. The first is limits of our understanding, and then the second is limits of our willpower, our actions, the things we do. Now, when I studied moral theology, which is just a clever way of saying what God might think about what we do, One of the helpful distinctions I was given there is between error and fault. Of course, we all make errors. If we make an error in a maths problem, that does not necessarily mean we are sinful as a result. What it means is we have a limit of understanding. And of course, one of the features of humanity is that we are all very limited. We all have a very limited subjective perspective. In fact, if you think about it, it's an absolute miracle, I would say, maybe even a proof of the work of the Holy Spirit, that we can get beyond those limits at all. If you've ever thought about the miracle of language, in which we can sort of understand each other some of the time just by making sounds. But how is it that the sounds I make can be understood by you? My perspective, my subjective experience of the world is so different from yours, and vice versa. We have limits to do with our circumstance, our background, our perceptions, our capacities. And therefore, it's only natural that our limits will regularly be leading us into error of different kinds. And that's not morally culpable, but it's something we need to be aware of. The sin that can underlie that, in fact, is the sin of refusing those limits, refusing to acknowledge that because we are not God, because we do not have God's perspective, we need constantly to be in the position of learners. So in terms of our own wisdom, thinking that we have understood it all, thinking that there's a source of explanation, is the thing that can draw us into morally culpable errors. But all of us will make errors as we go along anyway, because all of us have limited perspectives on what God is actually doing. So that's the wisdom side, if you like. If you take the side of action, this is where we get into things that we actually then choose or do or put into practice, which might go beyond errors, things which might involve a degree of moral fault. And we can identify those because they are the actions. Maybe they're to do with our limits. Maybe we're just being nasty, which we're all capable of being. Our sinful nature will lead us to actions which separate us from God, which separate us from each other, which separate us from ourselves, in fact. Sins against self-love are just as important, just as problematic as sins against neighbor and sins against God. And if we think about those sins in different ways, there's a whole industry from the dawn of Christianity, seven deadly sins, all of that. A lot of these are basically teaching tools to help us see if we can identify some of the different ways in which we are or can become aware of how we can fall into those patterns of behavior which hurt other people, hurt ourselves, and hurt God. You'll have heard me use this before. One of my favorite teaching tools is the formulation put together by Ignatius of Loyola. He uses it at the heart of his spiritual exercises. The three main categories of temptation to sin, which he defines, are riches, glamour, and pride. And against that, he sets the three monastic virtues, if you like, of poverty, chastity, and humility as steps down. Spiritual exercises we can use to try and counteract with our own flawed willpower the temptation of these three things. But thinking about the money in the temple particularly, I think one of the key aspects that can help us here is thinking about how, as part of that sinfulness, a part of our own limitations as well, one of the key sources of our sinfulness is depersonalizing the other, thinking in terms of me and my perspective and my selfish understanding, rather than thinking about myself as being in relationship with another. In the area of riches, for example, We can think of money as something which exists, which is in fact morally neutral, though tempting, which can create a whole economy of exchange among us, which can enable us all to flourish and thrive. Understood correctly, money is simply a tool for good relationships, what the great German rabbi Martin Buber called I-vow relationships, being in a relationship of personhood with the other, with money just as a tool. The problem comes when money becomes the main event, when money supplants the personal identity of the other. Similarly, glamour. We all have character attributes. We all have things about ourselves which are not so great. And so if we are in a relationship of mutual dependence, we are open to correction. We are open to love. We are open to reconciliation. But the dynamic of glamour puts some of our own attributes in a highlighted position. It essentially becomes a power dynamic whereby, through a degree of selfishness, we endeavor to use our relationships with others to get power over them in some way, which is why chastity is set up as the opposing principle for that, not necessarily strictly monastic chastity, because even people who have committed to celibacy can use their influence to get power over other people. God knows, if we haven't learned that in the 20th century, we've not been watching the life of our churches. But that true chastity is a determined commitment to be open and vulnerable in relationships with others, to keep that vow quality. Through certain kinds of commitment which prevent us from going down certain kinds of road. But underneath this, there's also a root of sinfulness. I've already alluded to it. Let's make it really clear now. The root of the sin of pride is really a sin of anxiety that God is not actually God. If you go back to the book of Genesis, the serpent tempting Adam and Eve, however one reads that story, it certainly is a story which, from a genre point of view, has qualities of myth and legend. A lot of the better Jewish scholars will read it in terms of its psychological power as a narrative, which reveals a whole range of things about human dynamics. But the seed of the sinfulness of Adam and Eve in that is questioning God's good intentions. Has God said? Does God really? And it's in the anxiety of that, which is understandable, because we don't have all the information, that Adam and Eve decide to make themselves gods and make their own decisions, going beyond the limits that are set for them. And that anxiety is understandable. It underpins a narrative of the world, a narrative essentially of scarcity. This world is not enough. I need to look after myself first. I cannot operate on an assumption that God is God and I am not, and God's providence, God's providential care, leads us to a way of living where we can live in that kind of community and dependence. Foolishness, if you like. And that narrative of scarcity can lead to the kind of financial relationships whereby, as scholars have told us who've looked at the first century temple, people in the temple were making rather more money than they should out of things which should have been part of an ordinary religious practice. The reason people were selling these sheep and cattle and doves was because of the sacrificial rituals of first century Judaism. But the fact that there started to become an unbalanced economic relationship with certain kinds of markup, the insistence on buying certain kinds of temple money. One can imagine the venue managers of the temple saying, well, we know we need to pay for this place, and therefore we need to come up with a financial and economic model which will underpin it. And so the best way to do that is to start putting significant markups on the products that people need to buy. And what's interesting is that at other places in the gospel, And in the scriptures, Jesus praises good stewardship. He praises financial responsibility. The truth in theology and in the scriptures is almost always balanced. It's almost always both and. So no one should read this parable on its own. Well, it's a living parable of Jesus' action and take conclusions which are thin or unbalanced from it. It's prudent for all institutions to have asset management plans and good financial infrastructure, all of these things. No one is going to argue with that. And yet underneath, places where institutions can fall into sin in these places is where they fall into a narrative of anxiety that God is not really God and they need to do God's work for God. Whereas against that, this other narrative, the narrative which we see throughout the scriptures, which is fundamental for the scriptures, fundamental in our psalm which we read today, is of God's providential, abundant provision, which leads to an invitation to a kind of trust, which of course is fundamental to all human relationships, all thy-thou relationships. And we have something like this with the cross as well, don't we? It would be so much easier if, in response to the desire for some nice systematic human wisdom or some dramatic sign, we had the kind of signs that would give us a copper-bottomed confidence that God was who God said, that God is who God said, that we can trust in a way which gives us no doubts, no uncertainties. And we know the world we are in is not that kind of world. Instead, the invitation the scriptures give us is to a kind of foolishness, a kind of self-abandonment, just like Jesus, who abandoned his own divinity to live in the most humble way. Rather than giving us all the answers, again, as those of us who've been studying Ephesians in our Lent group have been looking into, what God actually calls us to is a kind of receptivity to the idea that God might really be the kind of God of whom the scriptures speak. That God is actually the primary agent in the creation, salvation, sanctification, and gathering up of the world. That God is a person, in fact, three persons with whom we are in a living, loving relationship. And that much like any household which has a marriage at its core, which does not rely on the quality of that marriage as its first priority, is vulnerable, even if it's provided for in lots of other ways, that our first priority as Christians is to be stewards of our own receptivity through our own personal relationship with God. And how can this help us with wisdom and actions? Well, that openness, that relationship of a disciple to a teacher is precisely the place where we can experience the ongoing conversion, the growth, the change, the learning, the development of perspective, moving beyond our limits and learning in a stumbling way how to make actions that are slightly less selfish, slightly less bad. And it's a journey we are all on. It's a Lenten journey, and it goes on long beyond Lent. And yet we do it, we can only do it in the light of what Jesus has done for us. We are not God, Jesus is. Jesus has done the heavy lifting. Jesus has opened the way. The cross leads to the resurrection, and it's in that light that we can walk our own way of the cross, which is radically different from Jesus's. It is much more mediocre. It is less glamorous. We are not called to do the dramatic stuff. We are not called to make the grand gestures. Sometimes we might, but we need to be very cautious. But that's okay. In fact, it's just as well. Because on our journey of learning, as we gradually over our lifetimes begin to perceive what this foolishness of God might be as wisdom for us and for others, we are simply called to be patient spectators participants, sometimes, by the grace of God, collaborators, while God, who is God, is the one who saves us for God's glory and for the world's salvation. Amen.